couple of weeks ago, Arlene and I had a wonderful privilege, and we were invited over to Taylor and Maychelle's place, and Emmanuel. And of course, as anybody know who the star of the evening was? I mean, Taylor and Maychelle are pretty cool, but it wasn't Taylor and Maychelle. I'm sorry, Emmanuel. It wasn't Emmanuel. It was Titus. I mean, Titus is that, you know, the most darling little guy. And Arlene and I had all kinds of fun, you know, just kind of looking at Titus, doting over Titus. And sure enough, Arlene got the first opportunity to hold him. And then he was mine. And you know what? What a delight. It doesn't always happen this way, but it did happen this way. I mean, I was just standing and holding him and holding him, and guess what happened? He fell asleep. Sorry, David. David was thinking something very untoward. You know, that says something about David, not Titus. But Titus, he fell asleep in my arms. Now, there is no greater experience or feeling of contentment, right? Than when you're holding a little baby in your arms and that baby falls asleep. And he was sleeping for quite a while, and he's actually getting to be a little chubby. But we were having a good time. And of course, it took me back, you know, years ago when our kids were little. And there's that very short window of time. And if you've been a parent, you know what it's like. There's that short window of time when you can lie on the couch, and your baby just falls asleep, you know, on your stomach, and it is the most incredible. And then you fall asleep, and the baby, you know, it's just a wonderful picture. And now, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but how many of you would agree that parenting isn't always about children falling asleep in your arms? You know, Robin, even without asking for a show of hands, all right. But we know that that's the way it is. Now, you know, no surprise, but sometimes I like to think of church and pastoring a church as not in some ways that unlike parenting. All right, now you're a lot bigger, and it's not quite as easy to do that anymore. But it's not always a matter of just, you know, metaphorically falling asleep in each other's arms, right? There are those moments, and we know as parents that it just doesn't stay that way. And in fact, there are times when you might even wonder, how did this happen? Or why did this happen? Or why did I even agree to this whole idea, you know, of being a parent and so on? So there are all of these things that we deal with. Now, that's kind of what we're looking at this morning. Now, the title, I've been working on the sermon for a while, but I probably could have come up with a better title, but you will see the reason for the title at the very end of the message and how it ties together. But if I could have come up with a title, in fact, since the bulletin was printed, I was thinking of a song that it first came out in 1951, and then B.B. King. Anybody else like B.B. King, the blues guitarist? Okay, yeah. You know, I'm not going to try to imitate how he sings it, but, you know, there's a wonderful song. It's entitled "The Thrill Is Gone." You know the song, okay? It's a great blues song. So if you want to, you know, go on YouTube and you can watch it. But what does that have to do with this? Well, he talks about, you know, kind of in a relationship, how there are those times, and maybe you've been there, maybe you're there right now. And it might be that the relationship with your partner is not quite what it was, and maybe the thrill is gone. And sometimes, even in church life, and what we're going to look at this morning is we've been looking in the book of Acts at a time when everything was going great. I mean, the apostles, they're preaching Christ crucified, Jesus risen from the dead. And they're preaching with amazing authority. The miracles are happening. Lives are being changed. The people are responding. Remember, we've got this amazing Christian community happening. They're being generous. Nobody has any needs. Everybody is giving and sharing and participating in the life of the body. And everything is going great. But there are those experiences that come. And this is one that we're looking at this morning. In a sense, the thrill is gone. Now, remember, we looked at opposition. We looked at it a couple of weeks ago. And as Christians, even when we think of what Jackie was saying, there's always the tendency for us to think that the opposition always comes from outside. And if only we had, let's say, a different government, or if only we had, you know, different policies, that somehow that's when the church would flourish, everything would work out well. Now, we see in the book of Acts, actually, in some respects, it's very counterintuitive and it's very contrary to that, because, in fact, when they were experiencing the persecution from without. Now, we're not experiencing persecution. We're clearly not very popular in our culture right now. And there's certainly lots of policies that are very contrary to Christian faith and values. There's no question. But what they when they experienced in the book of Acts, if you like, full-fledged persecution, rather than causing them to pull back, they became bolder, more convinced than ever about the truth of Christ, more passionate about sharing their faith, and the result was, in fact, that people were responding in great numbers. And then we saw that some of the challenges not only came from outside, but some of the big challenges, and in some respects, even at times, some of the bigger challenges came from within. And we looked at, you know, the deceit that was going on, the story of Ananias and Sapphira. And so that's where we pick it up as we look today in Acts chapter, well, we're going to begin with the very latter part of Acts chapter 5. Remember, we've got Peter and John, all the apostles, they've been arrested, they've been told to stop preaching Christ, and of course, every time they're told to stop, they just continue and so on, and they are flogged. So it was a brutal beating that they received, they're released, and then look at verses 41 of chapter 5. The apostles left the Sanhedrin, and what do? It says they left rejoicing because they had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name. Now, I totally agree with what Jackie is saying, and in no way am I trying to take away from that. And we ought to do what we can. We should speak out when we can. We do it with love. We do it with grace. All of these things matter. But how do we respond when at times we experience opposition? Notice what they did. In other words, any opportunity to stand for Christ, any opportunity to suffer disgrace for the name of Jesus, the apostles viewed as an opportunity for rejoicing. Because in some incredible way, it is a participation in the sufferings of Christ. Not that the sufferings of Christ were not full and complete. His cross and what he did on the cross was absolutely final. It was complete and sufficient for all that we have and all of our needs, all of our sin, all of our failures. But there's another sense in which we get to participate with the sufferings of Christ. And so notice what they did day after day in the temple courts from house to house. They never stopped teaching, proclaiming the good news that Jesus is the Messiah. Now, with that going on, again, people responding, all kinds of energy and power. And now we get into chapter 6, and here's this incident of where the thrill is gone. In those days, notice, in those days, what? In those days of multiplication, people responding, in those days of even persecution, when the numbers of disciples was increasing, notice it's as the church is growing and expanding. Now we've got these two groups of people, the Grecian Jews, among them complained against the Hebraic Jews because their widows were being overlooked in the daily distribution of food. Now what's that about? Well, you remember, we see it all the way through the Old Testament. You see it often in the New Testament. That God is often pictured as being on the side of what? The people who are the marginalized, the poor, the vulnerable in society. You can look at, for example, Psalm 9:18. Notice what it says. God will never forget the needy. He will never forget the needy. The hope of the afflicted will never perish. Remember what James says in chapter 1:27. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after the orphans and the widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted, you know, by the world. You know, it's interesting that in those days, the church, they carried on in that tradition, and there was apparently a custom that they had in those days. Every Friday morning, and in fact, some say that happened every day, but in particular on Fridays, there were two collectors that were sent out from the synagogue. So synagogues would send out collectors, and they would go out into the marketplace, and they would visit people literally from house to house, and they would collect whether it was food items or money, and they would collect it and they would distribute it to the poor. Now, the ones who were always, in particular, the concern of all of the Jewish people at the time were those who were the widows. Because to be a widow in that society was to be incredibly vulnerable. I mean, it's a very different culture from today, but a woman's protection in those days was viewed as being very much part of being a household. And being under the protection, if you like, the roof, the comfort, the care, you know, of her husband. And so for someone to be a widow would be someone to be incredibly vulnerable in those days. Now, it talks about two groups of widows. Well, who were they? There were widows that were, if you like, born and lived in Palestine, the whole area of Israel today, that whole region. And so these were the widows who some might say, and some might have thought, well, you know, these are the ones who are, the closest to really being the purest Jewish widow that you could be. They were the ones that many of them would have spoken Hebrew. Many of them would have spoken Aramaic, and Aramaic was sort of the common language that was spoken in Israel at the time. And so they were the ones who, you know, lived there. They resided there. Now, it's not a perfect analogy, but it might be a little bit analogous to those of us who are citizens of Canada and who were born in Canada. Okay? There might be, and by the way, I realize this might, some might say, you know, Gord, don't go there. I'm going to go there. There is a tendency sometimes for those of us who have lived in Canada, been born in Canada, been born into citizenship, is it possible that we sometimes have a bit of an entitlement mindset? That somehow we're more deserving of this, or we are more pure, true Canadians than, let's say, others who are immigrants or more recent immigrants or are pursuing citizenship or permanent residency and all of this. Now, the reality is, isn't it true, that the reality is that I am, how far back do you want to go? How many generations back do we want to go? If I'm not an Indigenous Canadian, guess what? You know, I'm an immigrant, right? Is that true? The reality is that probably just about everybody in this church, you know, falls into that category. Now, this is not the point of the message, but it's an analogy of what was going on in Jerusalem at the time. There were those who had this mindset that we are the ones who are the true, if you like, Hebrews. And their widows were the ones that were getting the attention. They were the ones who were being properly cared for. They were getting provided for. But there were these other ones. Now, they were also Jews as well. They were also widows. They were also just as much in need. And in some respects, they were even more needy than everybody else. Why? Because many of them had come in. Some had come because of the Feast of Pentecost and stayed. Some of them were quite likely elderly. And there was always this hunger, this desire for every Jewish person, even the group that we might refer to as those who were part of the dispersion. Those who were, let's say, from outlying areas, not in Palestine, but there was this longing. And by the way, you see it in Israel today. There is still a longing that many Jewish people have that they will eventually be able to go back to Israel and ultimately die there. And that was the kind of thing that was going on in those days. And so you had many who came. Now, they were Grecian. In other words, their first language was Greek. Many of them knew nothing of Aramaic. Many of them knew hardly anything of Hebrew, but they were Jewish. And so what's going on? Well, the apostles. Now, this is rather striking. Because who were the ones who were responsible for the distribution of the food to the widows? It was the apostles, right? They were the ones who were looking after the church. They were responsible for the spiritual and material welfare of the church. And if you like, under their watch, what's going on? Under their watch, there is some kind of discrimination that is occurring. In other words, this practice of, you know, every Friday going out and collecting the food, it's a great custom, it was a great practice, but it was not uniformly practiced. You know, the measure of a leader, I don't know how you measure the effectiveness of a leader. Typically, I mean, if it's in business, do we add stakeholder value? Is there increase in profit? Is the business sustainable? Are you remaining in touch with all the contemporary trends, everything going? Are you positioning it for the future? There are all of these different things. In other words, you measure a leader, in most respects, you measure a leader based on the bottom line. Many times in churches, I've said to congregations, and don't worry, I'm not leaving. That's not what this is about. But I've often said that the measure of a leader is not often what happens when a leader is present, but what happens when the leader leaves. In other words, is it all about a personality? Is it that people respond because of the individual, or is there a real sense of attachment and loyalty to Christ and loyalty to the body? Another way to measure a leader is what happens during a crisis. Think of what happened. Anybody remember what happened in 2013? What happened in 2013? Yeah, there was the great flood, okay? It wasn't exactly the flood of Noah, but it was a pretty significant, flood in Calgary. Now, whatever you might think in terms of our civic politics today, and this is, again, not a political statement, but one of the things that stood out and one of the things that helped to cement the leadership of our present mayor was the way he navigated and the way he was able to work and bring people together during the crisis of the flood of 2013. So kudos, to Mayor Nenshi. That was very significant. The measure of a leader is how do you respond? How do you handle a time of crisis? Now, by the way, it's that way not only in government, not only that way in the city, but it's also that way in the church. And so the disciples or the apostles in this situation, what do? They're facing this division. Now, why is it so important? Well, they had this mandate from Jesus. What are they to do? They're to wait until they receive power. They're to be witnesses in Jerusalem, Samaria, the uttermost parts of the earth. And so this is what we sometimes refer to as mission critical. You don't get this right, this entire mission that we're involved with together really is frankly imperiled. And so what does it do? The 12 gather in verse 2. They gather all the disciples and they said, it would not be right for us to neglect the ministry of God or the word of God in order to wait on tables. Now, in a sense, you read that, it almost sounds like a rather, disparaging kind of comment, don't you think? It's almost like saying, you know what? We've got more important things to do. Don't bother us with this other stuff that really isn't that significant. But is that what they're saying? No, it's not what they're saying. In fact, as we look and see how they navigated this situation, it was not that serving tables and caring for the material needs of the widows was not important at all, but rather what they're saying is we've got a higher priority. It's something that was given to us by Christ. But what we are, in a sense, passing on is so significant that we need to handle it in a proper fashion. So what do? Well, they address the issue. They call a meeting. That's typically what we do in church life too, right? We call a meeting in terms of handling it. But I want us to notice this. They did not ignore it. You and I know what can happen in congregational life. And by the way, if you're a guest here this morning, some of what we're talking about, we talk about issues of conflict and whatever. It's not because that's what's going on at Trinity. This is where we are in our text. And sometimes it's a good thing for us to remind ourselves of these principles about how do you handle, let's say, misunderstandings, or how do you handle unmet needs in the body. Sometimes it's a good thing to think this through and to kind of figure it out before something happens so that you've got a bit of a template that you can follow. I want you to notice that they were directive, but not dictatorial. Think, for example, of how Trinity functions. Who's the leader of Trinity? Don't say out loud. Ultimately, it's God, okay? Jesus is the head of the church. How are we governed? Well, our governance, our system of governance is we are congregational, which means what? The buck stops with you. It stops with us as a congregation. Make sense? Okay? Now, a congregational government, what have we done? Well, we have chosen to call a pastor. We've chosen to elect elders. And so what happens is that a congregation in order to get the day-to-day stuff done, in order for planning to happen, because it's incredibly inefficient to have, do you want to honestly meet on every single issue all the time? Nobody would want to do it. It would be incredibly frustrating and ultimately very unmanageable. So what do? You delegate. But notice what they did. They were directive. The apostles thought it through. They suggest a plan, and we'll see what their plan was. But notice that they were not dictatorial. So that's how we govern. In other words, it's almost like we're dancing together. Sometimes, you know, the elders take the lead on the dance. Sometimes the pastor takes the lead on the dance. Sometimes the congregation, you know, takes the lead on it. But ultimately, we're all dancing together. Yikes, did I say that in a Baptist church? All right, I did. Okay. I'm really going to be in trouble at the next elders meeting, I think. No, not really. Not at all. Take a look at what they did. So look at verse 3. What do they do? Brothers, choose 7 men. By the way, 7 is not just an arbitrary number. It was considered almost a sacred number. There are numbers of places in the scriptures where the number 7 in terms of leadership was significant. Choose 7 men from among you. Notice who are full of the Spirit and wisdom. We will turn this responsibility over to them, and we will give our attention to prayer and the ministry of the Word. Now, we're not going to look at the whole text, and so, Anthony, I'm going to go through very quickly. But remember in chapter 18 of Exodus, you have a similar situation. You've got Moses, and Moses is responsible for leading the nation of Israel. It was a massive group of people. And people are coming to him all the time. He's the one who morning, noon, and night, when people have issues or conflicts or challenges, he's teaching them spiritual truth. And he's the one who's arbitrating with whenever there's an issue or a conflict going on. And he is wearing out. Remember what happened? His father-in-law, what does he do? His father-in-law says, Moses, what you're doing is not good. What you need to do is you need to appoint leaders of thousands and hundreds and so on, and you turn over most of the responsibility to them. But, you know, the hardest cases, all right, they can bring them to you nonetheless. And so that's what he does. And ultimately, in verse 23 of chapter 18, it says, if you do this, then God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied. Look at what they do in Acts chapter 6. 5 and 6, it says this. This proposal, what did it do? It pleased the whole group. They chose Stephen, a man full of faith of the Holy Spirit, Philip, and then we have a whole series of names. Look at verse 6. They presented these to the apostles who prayed and laid their hands on them. Now, you know, a cursory reading, we might miss something that I think is quite significant. If you look at all the names, anything that you notice? Anything you notice about them? Are they Greek names or Hebrew names? They're Greek names, okay? Now, most of them were Jews. One was evidently a Gentile, but a proselyte to Judaism. Now, why is that significant? One of the challenges always, in church life, there's always a challenge. Well, how do you navigate change? How do you, in a sense, entrust responsibility to other people, to new people? How do we avoid an us versus them kind of situation? Now, remember, who were the widows who were being neglected? Were they Hebrew or Jew? I mean, Hebrew or Greek? They were Greeks. Now, do you think there's any significance that the apostles, well, ultimately it was the group, but they were suggested the apostles, but nonetheless they chose, the people chose. And who do they choose? You know, we might think that in order to protect things, in order to make sure that everything is done, you know, decently and in order, the way it has always been done before, would be for us to appoint what? The Hebrew men in order to correct the problem. Because after all, we know them. They've been with us a long time. Do you follow me? In a sense, that would be the normal response, and frankly, is probably how, in many cases, most churches would do this. Make sense? But what do? They chose from the group that was being, if you like, ignored, people who were trusted and respected within that community. Does that make sense? which I think was a very strategic move. It was very wise, but it also was potentially risky. Make sense? And yet, that's what they did. Now, in church life, it's always one of the challenges. And for churches to grow, for churches to move forward, for churches to sometimes get new ideas, sometimes it's a challenge, and yet, you know what? It often is a wise thing, particularly when there are ministry needs and in congregations from time to time, whether they're unmet needs or they're new opportunities. A conviction that I have is that God puts within congregations the abilities, the gifts, the skill sets, the wisdom, the experience, all the things that ultimately are needed in order to move that congregation forward for the glory of God. Do we embrace people in leadership too quickly? Sometimes yes, but you know, sometimes also no. So what do they do? Well, they responded, and the need was met. And the amazing thing was, it's kind of an interesting statement, because not only did they lay their hands on them, but in verse 7, it is surprising because you see that the church continued to grow, to multiply. And then you have that very interesting statement. Because think for a moment, who were the groups that were opposing the believers at this time? Where was the outside opposition coming from? It was coming from the religious leaders, remember? You know, the Sanhedrin, it was coming from the Pharisees, it was coming from, you know, the Sadducees, it was coming from all of the religious elite. And now what happens is what? This church has addressed this challenge, this problem. They've delegated, they've built it up. They figured out how to navigate these very difficult waters. The result is that the mission is able to move forward. The church continues to grow and expand. And many of the priests, many of the prime opponents are now responding in faith to Christ. You know, church life is not always about babies falling asleep on your stomach or falling asleep in your arms. That is a picture of contentment, and it's wonderful. But you know what? In parenting, it isn't always that way. And it doesn't always stay that way in church life as well. And many of us have known that. Many of us have experienced that. Where there is life, notice this, where there is life, there will inevitably be variance of opinion. Make sense? Am I wrong on that? The only place where there's no variance of opinion is when there is no life. True? But where there is life, where there are new vision or new ideas, all of that, so it has to be handled well. Many of the challenges that churches deal with come from legitimate needs that are not being met. And when often we think it through, and you know, sometimes, and I'll be honest, I have met in my lifetime some nasty Christians. There are some who are nasty. They're the ones, you know, where in Proverbs, I think chapter 6 addresses some of these things. You could look at that at your own times. But the point is this, that the majority of cases where there are things that are brought up, where there are opinions, where there are challenges, where there's a difference of opinion, it's not because they're coming from bad people. Most of the time, it's as in the early church, there may be needs that are being unmet. There might be the needs, whether it's widows or whether it's young people or whether it's seniors or whether it's singles or whether it's married, or it could be any number of things that are going on. And so the challenge of leadership is not to ignore, but to address, and to do it in the spirit of Christ. Leaders provide direction, involve others in decision making, and then delegate so that ultimately the need is met. You know, if God should choose to bless Trinity Baptist Church, to bless us even numerically and bring people into our church, whether they're new believers or whether they're new arrivals in our city, I've met some this morning, And I know they're checking us out. And you know what? It's a good thing to do. Check out churches. And that's fine. But this morning, we have people who are visiting us for the first time from other cities that have just visited. They happen to come by. And this is the church that they landed at this morning. How do we respond as a church? And how will we respond as a church? If God chooses for us to grow, it will not come without challenges. It will not come without, at times, even variances and variance of opinion. But the way we will handle it, brothers and sisters, will be the very same way that they handled it in Acts chapter 6. In other words, opinions are welcome here. I want you to know that. Opinions are welcome here. New ideas are welcome here. Can we meet them all? Can we satisfy every need? No. But you know what? That is one reason why we have so many churches in our city. There's no one church that will satisfy the needs and be able to address every person's ideas and vision in terms of the way things should be done. And that's fine. That's called the body of Christ. And that's okay. But we have a part to play. And it's as we follow these kinds of things, in other words, as leaders, as pastors, as elders, we don't ignore it, we don't brush it aside, we don't just kind of let issues go and go under the carpet, because what happens is they simply go underground. And ultimately, the conflict eventually arises and the church is damaged. But we communicate, we do it graciously, we do it lovingly. Let's move and wrap this up, though, in one particular way. How many of you have ever heard of the Pareto Principle? That familiar? The Pareto Principle. Now, nobody's raised their hand, but if I were to say, have you ever heard of the 80-20 rule? There you go. Everybody knows the Pareto Principle, okay? Pareto was an Italian economist in the 19th century. Pareto noticed this, Vilfredo, I don't know how to pronounce it. But anyway, Pareto, essentially what he discovered, no surprise, that 80% of all the peas in agriculture came from 20% of the pods. He found that 80% of the land in Italy was owned by 20% of the people. And then he went on and developed this, but there's all kinds of things. And in business circles today, everybody talks about the 80-20 rule. And it goes like this. Typically, 80% of your revenue will come from 20% of your clients. It's also true, not uncommonly, that 80% of your problems also come from 20%. All right? Now, how does this apply into church life? You know, oftentimes, it's the very same thing. And by the way, I want you to know that not only here, but every church I've pastored, I do not know, and I intentionally do not know, the specifics of individual giving. Okay? The reason is, I in no way ever want my knowledge of people's giving to impact the way that I treat them. So, 80%, I can't say for sure, but my guess is, if Don were to come up and tell us, we'd probably find out that probably 80% of the revenue of Trinity comes from something like 20% of the congregation. It's often that way. You'll often find that in terms of workforce, volunteerism, and various things, you'll often find a similar truth, that the bulk of the work that's done in a church is often done by 20% of the people. Now, the good news is Trinity's higher than that. It's probably, you know, Paul, we were talking about numbers in terms of involvement in small groups and so on, and it's probably more like, you know, 40, 50% that are involved in small groups. I think, does that sound somewhere, you know, we can double check our stats. But the point is this, that the level of involvement is higher, and in a smaller church, it's not surprising that that's the case. But the point still is that it's going to require the participation, both in terms of revenue and volunteerism and all of these things. Let me illustrate as I bring this to a close. Many years ago, there was a preacher, writer by the name of Fred Craddock, and he was speaking to a group of ministers. This is what he said. He said, "To give my life for Christ appears glorious. To pour myself out for others, you know, to pay the ultimate price of martyrdom. He says, I'll do it. You know, I'm ready, Lord, to go out in a blaze of glory." And then he used another analogy. He said, we think that giving our all to Jesus is a little bit like taking a $1,000 bill. I've never seen one, but anyway. He said it's like taking a $1,000 bill, we think, and sort of laying it all on the table. Here's my life, Lord, I'm giving it all. But he said the reality is that for most of us, the Lord sends us to the bank and he has us cash in the $1,000 bill for quarters. And we go through life putting out 25 cents here, 25 cents here, 50 cents there. You know, we listen to somebody who's hurting. We welcome somebody. We bring something to the food bank. You know, we do something and we share, you know, the gospel when we have opportunity. And we do all of these different things. We serve in a committee. We teach Trinity kids. We lead a Bible study. You know, any number of things that we do. We bring soup to a monthly soup luncheon and so on. And he says, usually giving our life to Christ isn't glorious. It's done in those little acts of love. 25 cents at a time. It would be easy in some ways to go out in a flash of glory, but it's harder to live the Christian life little by little over the long haul. And sometimes when we think of missions, we might again think in a similar way. Wow, if I could just go and serve Christ in some jungle or some urban center somewhere, you know, then I'm really going to be serving Christ. And he may very well call some of us here to serve in some other country. But in many respects, what he's calling us to do is to cash in our lives. And piece by piece, moment by moment, sticking it out in your marriage, being faithful parents, being godly workers, being ethical business people, being faithful and good neighbors, being consistent in prayer, carrying on in terms of hearing the gospel, serving in a church, being loyal, the character of Christ, moment by moment, being faithful in all areas. You know, we might think that feeding the hungry in Calgary would be a whole lot easier if some billionaire would donate $100 million. But you know something? It really probably happens one can of soup at a time. As we participate, as we get involved. We might think that it happens when somebody somewhere does something, and it maybe happens when some of you and some of us will join Sherry and Andrew at Hope Mission, you know, on November 23rd, helping in a small way and then seeing how that develops and what God might want to do with us in our church.